folks, this is Anatoly, and you're listening to the No Sharding Podcast. And today I have an awesome guest, Justin Drake, who's been working on VDFs, part of the Ethereum Foundation VDF Research Project. So really excited to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So I guess you want to like maybe do a brief intro of who you are and how you got into VDFs?
Okay, sure. I mean, I'm Justin Drake. I'm kind of a geek. I studied mathematics, and then I did some programming stuff, and then I discovered Bitcoin in 2013 and went down the rabbit hole pretty quickly. I was doing some Bitcoin stuff for a while, but then in 2015, I started a Bitcoin company, which didn't do so well. And then in 2017, I kind of spent most of my time thinking about, towards the end of 2017, spent most of my time thinking about Ethereum. And specifically, I've been thinking about Ethereum 2.0. And, you know, one of the big pieces of Ethereum 2.0, as you know, is sharding. And in order to do sharding, you need to do these randomly selected committees that are kind of statistically representative of a larger pool of validators, and you need randomness for that. So I went down the randomness route and tried to find the best solution possible. And there's a few ways to do decentralized randomness, and basically discovered that VDFs is probably the best way forward for us, given our constraints for Ethereum 2.0.
In your words, can you describe what a VDF is?
Sure, yeah. So it's kind of this really cool cryptographic primitive, which falls under what I call cryptophysics. And so cryptophysics is cryptography meets physics. So we've had proof of work, which kind of is when cryptography meets energy consumption, and VDFs is a similar thing.
I like to think of proof of work as entropy, right? It's proof of entropy.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I like to think about it in terms of like you're proving that you've spent some energy. And you do a similar thing for VDFs where you prove that you've spent time. So you prove that there's been some time consumed, and that's what we mean by delay. So it's somewhat different to a clock, which will tell you what time it is. So it's, I don't see it as a proof of time. And that's maybe an area of debate because you're working with proofs of time. I see it as a proof of delay, which is basically saying that a minimum amount of time has gone through, but it could have been more time that has gone through.
I'd like your distinction is that when folks, like, again, when I do the explanation, people initially think that it's like a clock, like a digital dial, but instead it's like little pieces of proofs of delay, right, that kind of make a sand clock or something like that. So I really like how you describe that.
Yeah, I mean, the basic problem is that different people will have different hardware to do this sequential computation, which can be efficiently verified, at the end by verifying a proof. And basically, you need to make assumptions about how fast an attacker can go relative to what you can do or what, commodity hardware can do. So if you're assuming, for example, that an attacker can go no more than 10 times faster than your hardware, then if you want a guaranteed delay of 1 minute, you're gonna need to run your hardware for 10 minutes because the 10 minutes could have been compressed down to only 1 minute if it was run on this like super fancy attacker hardware, which is 10 times faster than your hardware.
So the way I imagine it, right, is like, it's almost like we have a mechanical clock, right? And it's bound by the speed of the actual gears in there. And like, imagine somebody's trying to run this thing as fast as possible. The if they run it too fast, the gears break and the clock stops working. And I hate to use the term clock, but like you're literally like moving electrons through a circuit, right? And as fast as you can, and doing state transitions that are cryptographically secure such that nobody can predict them, right?
Right. So in addition to sequentiality, you kind of want like unpredictability. I mean, that's kind of the whole point, is that you need to do all the sequential work in order to get an output which is unpredictable. I mean, the reason why I think VDFs are not, you know, good as clocks, like traditional clocks, is that, you know, different people will have different hardware, and basically the notion of time consumption is kind of subjective. So different people will have different speeds at which time passes in this context.
Yeah, it is not like a clock that you would rely on for accuracy in terms of making sure that things physically happen at the same time.
Right. But I'd argue it you couldn't even use it for like sequential ordering. So if
like we're doing, which is using it as a vector, effectively as a Lamport clock.
Yeah, I don't think you can use it that way. So, you know, let's say that you have two people and you kind of want to order them, right? Like you want one to do, you know, 10 units of sequential work and the other one to do 20 units of sequential work. And then you kind of wait to see when the outputs come, and you know, you'd kind of expect the first one to come first after 10 units of sequential work. And then you can say, okay, they should, you know, produce a block or whatever now. And then, you know, a bit later, this other person can produce a block, and you can. But the problem is that what if the second person has hardware which is at least twice as fast as the first one? Then, you know, they can make it look like to the network that, you know.
Yes. Yeah. So what we're doing, just to give you like maybe a better explanation, is we're creating a forced delay that on average works pretty well. And when it doesn't work, it's no different than if two blocks are produced at the same time in any other network, right? So what we're able to do is introduce this forced delay to stagger the block producers, and an attacker with a faster hardware can censor the previous set. Depending on the speed of their hardware, they can potentially censor some of the previous block producers.
Okay, so I guess what you're saying is that the infrastructure that you have is no worse than the status quo. And so in the optimistic case, it's like a strict improvement over the status quo.
Exactly. And all of engineering is taking the best case and blood, sweat, and tears and making it the average case, right?
I mean, we're taking a very similar approach for Ethereum 2.0. So we have this this RANDAO, which is a great way, a very simple way to produce randomness, which is biasable. And then we kind of amplify it or enhance it to become unbiasable by combining RANDAO and VDFs. But in the very worst case, where VDS are completely broken, you fall back to RANDAO. And so in that sense, it's a strict improvement. And there are some, you know, worst case scenarios out there where, for example, if the sequentiality assumption is broken for some reason, then you still have the security of the underlying RANDAO.
So the sequentiality assumption, to me, like, when I don't want to say discovered this, but I kind of like stumbled on this thing when I was just simply kind of trying to understand proof of work and why it's so slow. And I had, as the legend goes, right, I had like two coffees and a beer and I was up in 4 a.m. And this kind of like hit me like a brick, like that you can use sequentiality of this pre-image resistant function to create a proof of elapsed time. And why that was to me so like mind-boggling insane was that this is like the era of time, right? There is no mathematical definition of time. we can't even prove that there's such a thing as irreversible functions, you know? Like, are you familiar with that?
Vaguely. Is it like these quantum circuits and stuff like that?
Right. So like, if you think of like a computation, like let's say I want to add two numbers, right? I have a register and another register. And let's say these are implemented as atoms, right? These are atomic, like at the physical level, right? When I combine the two, the accumulator, right, holds a now combined state. And if you run this backwards, you get back to the original values, right? There's no proof that we can construct a set of state transitions at the atomic level or mathematical level that you can't reverse backwards, outside of quantum mechanics, which I'm not even going to pretend to understand. I know enough to know that I don't understand it. So that means like we kind of don't have like an idea of what time is, right? Like we don't have a mathematical proof of what time is. But if we have some assumptions about cryptography is such that there's such a thing as pre-image resistance, then using the sequential setup, we have a proof that time exists, right? Because now you have irreversible functions, in, at least in the sense that they're cryptographically strong, right? And you kind of create this vector of in the direction which time moves. And to me, that was like really almost like a, I don't know. It felt like I was like paranoid for like 4 days that I like discovered something like really important.
I mean, I think it is pretty important, but I think it was possibly, you know, previously discovered by
100%. Yeah, I couldn't figure out what to search for in the internet to find it, but there have been like super smart folks working on this stuff before, and like RSA locks, I think, are a really good example of it.
Yeah, I mean, so going back to the sequentiality stuff, there's, if I were to have a more fine-grained understanding, there's actually two types of sequentiality. There's like the macro sequentiality, and this is basically saying that, you know, if, for example, if you have a hash chain, like clearly you can't, you know, jump from, you know, hash number one to hash number 1000. Like you have to go through the intermediate steps. So you have this nice macro sequentiality. But then there's also this notion of micro sequentiality, which is that within a single hash in a hash chain, like potentially you could build a circuit which is extremely parallel, and that would give you the answer significantly faster than what commodity hardware can do. I mean, like a very extreme example, which doesn't apply to your construction, but maybe it will help you understand, is if you were to implement a massive lookup table, right? Like a lookup table with, you know, as it grows, it consumes like exponential space, but then the circuit depth is very, very small. So you're trading off very low latency for lots of parallelism. And it's possible. Well, that
you still have your routing to actually go find the values in the lookup table are going to be log the size of the table, right? So there's no free lunch, right?
Yeah, so you need to look at two things. You need to look at the circuit depth, which is basically the number of transistors in the critical path. And you know, each transistor will, you know, take a certain amount of time to compute, to flip. And then you need to look at the wire length, which tends to be something more subtle and more difficult to analyze. But yeah, you're right. The wire length would also grow exponentially, because if you were to fit all the transistors perfectly in space, as in if you were to try and fit them in a three-dimensional ball, you know, if the number of transistors grows exponentially and you take the cube root of something exponential, you still get something exponential. And so because the speed of light is limited, then, you know, these brute force lookup tables don't work precisely because of routing of wire length. But, you know, it's possible that for SHA-256, there's some circuits which don't have this exponential blow up. and still have extremely low circuit depth.
Yeah, like if I like, my understanding is that there's no such proof that says that if you have one function that is, has any kind of property like pre-image resistance, and you run it sequentially, that there isn't a circuit that is faster, right, than running that thing sequentially. But it's that there's no such proof that we can't like take some, that there isn't a property we can define about any function that says that sequential operations cannot be reduced in size. So even if we couldn't use a lookup table, potentially if I just unroll in hardware 5 SHA-256s, I might be able to find a shorter path that's now 3 times faster than the trivial, you know, sequential implementation.
So actually it turns out that this, I kind of disagree a little bit here. So there's a very recent paper from Rotem and Segev. It's on vdfresearch.org if you're interested. And basically what it proves is that if you take the RSA VDF where you're doing repeated squaring inside an RSA group, it proves that basically being able to speed up this repeated squaring is equivalent to factoring the modulus in the RSA group.
Got it.
So, I mean, they've cheated a little bit. So what they've done is that they've taken the RSA group and they have what is called the generic ring model. So they, what can you do with, you know, with a number, you can add it and you can multiply it with another number. So you have these two operations, it makes it a ring. And what the generic ring model tells you is that you can do these operations, but you can't look at the exact details of the representations of these elements. So in the case of an RSA group, you're given a point and you can't look at its bits. You can only kind of do these operations plus multiply and equality. And in this model, they were able to prove that it's equivalent to factoring, which is like the best kind of security reduction you'd hope to expect. Because if factoring is easy, then the whole RSA-based class of VDFs falls down.
I mean, like intuitively to me, it feels like that should apply to any kind of, like if I have some cryptographically hard operation, then if you can optimize it sequential, if you can break it in a sequential setting, then you can break the original one too, right? Or if you can speed it up, right? Like it's just like my guts say yes, but I know I don't think there's a proof, right?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Like my intuition would say that for your specific construction, which is like a hash chain, the answer is yes. I mean, especially if you model your hash as a random oracle, then I think the proof is pretty trivial. But and you know, we often model hashes as random oracles. So yeah, I agree that proving anything about hashes is difficult because it's not really the realm of cryptography. It's more like the realm of cryptanalysis, which is more like black magic. But if you are to make these kind of assumptions, which we do make in practice all the time, then I think the proofs become pretty easy.
So you guys have made, like, I think every time I talk to you, you guys have made kind of insane progress on building hardware and in terms of design. And you guys, can you kind of tell me like where you guys are at today, with VDFs and, yeah, and actual hardware?
Yeah, sure. I mean, let me start from CPUs and then kind of go down all the way to ASICs. So if you were to run the sequential operation on the CPU, which is basically 2000-bit modular squaring, then it takes roughly 1000 nanoseconds per iteration.
And this is already like SIMD optimized, like
It's using the GMP library, which is pretty optimized. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And what there's a cool story here because Rivest, Shamir, and I think Wagner in 1996 created these RSA time lock puzzles, which you mentioned. Rivest loves puzzles. So, you know, he had this RSA challenge where he invited people to try and factor these RSA numbers, but he also had another challenge, which was this time lock puzzle where he encrypted a message to the future. So what does that mean? So he took a message, the plain text, he encrypted it in such a way that you can only decrypt the message after you've done some amount of work. And so he tried to calibrate the amount of work so that the time lock puzzle took 30 years, you know, taking into account the speed up from Moore's law and things like that. And it turns out he got the 30-year estimate kind of right. It actually took 20 years, and it was cracked last year. And it was this guy who was basically running the time lock puzzle on his laptop for several years, and you know, was running at 1,000 nanoseconds per iteration, roughly. So what we did with the VDF Alliance trying to speed up these operations is that we decided to implement a solution in an FPGA. And we got the latency per iteration down to something like 60 nanoseconds or 50 nanoseconds. And we were able to crack the puzzle in 3 months. And it turns out that this guy who was running on a CPU for several years and us who cracked it in 3 months on an FPGA, we actually cracked the solution roughly at the same time, like a couple days difference. It was quite a coincidence. Anyway, there was a whole ceremony at MIT with Ron Rivest. There's a Wired article which goes through that if you're interested. But the next step was basically to do this FPGA competition. So we knew that FPGAs could do these things pretty damn fast relative to CPUs. But we wanted to understand how much faster we could improve our solution. So we had a $100,000 FPGA competition in collaboration with various folks like AWS, Xilinx, and Synopsys, which are like hardware providers. And we actually got it down to, I think, 25 nanoseconds per iteration. Which
on FPGAs still?
Yes, on FPGAs.
Wow.
And between...
this implementation for RSA modulo, like this is the modulo exponentiation, right?
Yes.
And this can be used for RSA accumulators and basically any kind of like RSA-based operation, right?
Yes, at the first approximation, yes. So what you're doing is, it's a very simple modulo exponentiation, which is basically you're computing x to the power 2 to the power t, where t is some sort of time parameter. And so basically the way that you would compute this modulo exponentiation in practice is just you do repeated squaring. If you want to use RSA groups for things like accumulators or things like vector commitments or SNARKs, then it turns out you want to do a modulo exponentiation where the exponent is some sort of random looking number with lots of ones and zeros, as opposed to 2 to the power t, which has a one and lots of zeros.
Got it. See, yeah, that's kind of you need a difference. I'm guessing you guys are optimizing for the fact that it's squaring.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big advantages is that we only need to provide t to the hardware, and then it'll just do the whole thing. If you were to use RSA groups for, you know, accumulators or SNARKs or whatever, then suddenly you need to communicate this big random number to the hardware accelerator, and that could you know, create some IO bottlenecks, which you basically need to re-architecture things to handle the IO. But from a computational standpoint, it's relatively similar.
Oh, okay. That's not too bad then, because that's great. Well, like I hope, okay, so you guys are 25 nanoseconds on FPGA. So yes. What happened next?
So the next step is we have some folks at Supranational. So Supranational is a startup that started maybe a year or a year and a half ago, which was founded by three Intel guys who had been at Intel for 20 years. So they know this hardware space really well. And they've basically been designing a circuit which does this stuff extremely fast. And they've even collaborated with another one of their colleagues who came up with a new way to do modular exponentiation, which has lower circuit depth, as in even faster. So there's innovations both algorithmically and in terms of, you know, doing the engineering work for the ASIC. And the latency that we have today is around 2 nanoseconds.
And this is on a,
this is on a 60 nanometer FinFET process. So somewhat advanced, but not like super state of the art advanced.
And you guys already taped it out? Like it's already shipped?
No, so hardware is extremely difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things that we're considering kind of as a way to test, you know, that what we've been doing is good work is basically to do what's called a shuttle. So when you're building hardware, you have a very high upfront cost to build the so-called masks. So the masks are these things through which you shine the light to basically print out the ASICs. And, you know, a mask set, because you have various layers, and so you need a set of masks, a mask set will cost millions of dollars, you know, let's say $3 million or, you know, maybe $5 million if you have a very advanced node. So
the cost basically goes up the more recent the node is. So, like, I think 40 nanometers, you can probably get under $500,000.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But,
you know, for the 16 nanometer stuff, we're talking, you know, a few million dollars. And so what is done in practice to amortize this upfront cost is that you have a mask which is shared between multiple people, and that's called a shuttle. So you only pay, let's say, $250,000 or $500,000, and there's like 20 people who are sharing the same mask. So the downside is that you only get, you know, very low volume of hardware. You get a few samples, let's say 100 chips. And so it's very good to test your assumptions and make sure that you have a good design, but it's not good for production. And so that's something that we're considering in the medium term. But even before we can think about doing the production run, we actually need to solve another really, really big problem, which is the RSA modulus. So what is this RSA modulus? We need a number which is the product of two large primes, let's say two primes each of size 1,000 bits, so for a total of 2,000 bits, in such a way that no one knows what is the factorization. And, you know, there's various ways you can do that, but the most promising way that we see to achieve that is to do an MPC where you have lots of participants that jointly produce this RSA modulus. And the factorization is unknown so long as only one of these participants is acting honestly, meaning that any randomness that they contribute to the RSA MPC will be destroyed. So this is, you know, similar in terms of security guarantees to the kind of trusted setup that you have, for example, for Zcash or for Aztec.
Yeah, and this is like another kind of really complicated problem to pull off. I think, like, I remember one of your suggestions was that you should also throw in like dead cryptographers' public keys, right?
Yeah. So one thing that you can do is that you can run multiple VDFs in parallel. And if only one of the VDFs is sound, then the whole thing is sound. And so one thing that we could do is that we could run one VDF where the RSA modulus, for example, was generated by Ron Revest for this RSA challenge that I was talking about. And we could have one VDF also in parallel, well, in parallel to this first one that comes from the RSA MPC. And that's just a possibility. But right now, the current plan is just to go with one from the RSA MPC. And the reason is that we want to burn the modulus in the ASIC. So the advantage of having a circuit which is custom designed for this one modulus is that you can have a circuit which is faster and consumes less power and uses less area. And so overall, the whole solution is just more efficient and cheaper.
And that won't be reprogrammable?
It won't be reprogrammable, yeah.
Okay, interesting.
So that means that we really need to do the RSA MPC properly. Otherwise, we're jeopardizing all the hardware that we would build downstream from that.
And you can't, it seems like, what is the difference between having like a rewritable segment there that's in the hardware itself versus a read-only one? Is there that much speed up?
Yeah, so, one of the considerations, for example, is that we invented this new algorithm to do modular squaring. And it's based on these lookup tables. So if you have the modulus, which is hard-coded, you can actually replace the lookup table, which is usually implemented with memory.
Got it.
With just wires.
Yeah. Okay, got it. And if it's, and you would have to basically create like almost like a, how big is this table?
So to give you an order of magnitude, a 2000-bit modular multiplier using this stuff is about 64 million transistors. And that's with the hard-coded modulus. If we were not hard-coded, we'd potentially be talking hundreds of millions of transistors, which starts to become a relatively beefy thing. But the other thing to consider is that we want decentralization of people running these VDF evaluators. So the security of the things that we're building very often require only one single person in the world to be running the VDF hardware. And so if you want to guarantee with high probability that there's at least one such person, you want to give away the hardware to these people, but you also want the cost of running the hardware to be low, right? If you have a huge power consumption, that's going to lead to a high electricity bill at the end of the month, and people might just decide to unplug the hardware. Or if it uses too much power, then it might produce a lot of heat, and then you might need fans, and that's going to produce a lot of noise, which is going to make maybe your partner unhappy, and then that will make you unplug the machine as well. So having low power consumption is an important design consideration.
Are you guys imagining that the generators are going to run on like a USB dongle or something like that? Like folks are going to like plug them in? Because I think one of the goals for Ethereum 2.0 is that it runs on pretty low powered hardware.
Right. So the validators in Ethereum 2.0 and the VDF evaluators are actually completely distinct groups of people. You can be a validator without being an evaluator, and you can be an evaluator without being a validator.
Got it. Okay.
But yeah, you're right that even for the evaluators, we want them to be running reasonable hardware. And the kind of the form factor that we have in mind is like a little box, like a Mac Mini, and you plug it in a wall and you just forget about it. But you're right that if there, so the reason why we're thinking of the Mac Mini form factor is that we're actually thinking of having multiple randomness beacons run in parallel, so that you get randomness more frequently. So you have these staggered randomness beacons. and you get randomness roughly once every epoch. And in order to do that, you need to have multiple chips running in parallel. So the USB form factor won't work, but it's possible that there's different applications where you don't need, you know, as high security or as many random numbers, and the USB form factor would work better when you have only one or maybe two VDF evaluators on a single piece of hardware.
Do you guys see, so you guys are specifically using it for randomness. Do you guys see any other applications for VDFs in Ethereum 2.0?
Yes. So, I mean, one interesting application is anti-front running. So when you have a decentralized exchange, for example, and, you know, the order book is public, and the transactions that come in, the orders, are also public, then there's a big problem because the miners can essentially front run you, or even other people can try and front run you by raising the gas price. And so one design consideration here is that you can make the order kind of be encrypted like a time lock, and it would go on the blockchain encrypted in such a way that there's no information leaked. And then after a certain amount of time, anyone could decrypt the order, and then you would be able to execute the order there and then according to the order it went on chain, but that, yep, that order won't be subject to front running. There's another design which folks are also exploring, which is that ahead of time, you run a VDF on your order, and for someone to be able to front run you, they need to have a corresponding order with at least as much work, as much sequential time that has passed that you have spent. So it starts becoming extremely expensive to do these front running attacks, because basically you need to be running lots of VDFs in parallel for all the different possibilities front running that you want to do, and it just becomes unfeasible to attack.
Yeah, and then it becomes a proof of work system.
Right.
I was like, when I was first kind of designing Solana, I was trying to think of a way to use the VDF itself as the Sybil resistant voting scheme, and you always end up being back in like proof of work land.
Right.
Yeah, you could try to, like, you know, there's, I think, Starkware had an interesting design where it's kind of weighted VDFs, but I don't know how much you gain as soon as you start adding some other non-physical property, like some kind of stake weighting or anything like that, because you're back to proof of stake land, and then it's proof of stake, which to me is always some version of PVFT, no matter what you do.
Yeah, I'm not aware of this weighted stuff from Starkware. I mean, what I do know from Starkware is that they have a really cool construction, which, as I see it, is kind of the long-term winner for several reasons. So number one is that it's the only quantum secure VDF that we know of. I mean, yours is also quantum secure, but I'd argue it's not a VDF. It's a kind of a proto VDF.
It's a delay function you can verify. Actually, Dan Bonet told me I could call it a VDF. So,
sure.
So I have the blessing from the guru, right?
Sure. But, you know, in Ethereum 2.0, we want the verification cost to be very small. And yeah, the only construction that we know of that has this and is quantum secure is the Stark-based stuff. And the other big advantage is that it doesn't require a trusted setup. So, yeah, I'm very excited that they've launched the product Vdoo like maybe a couple of days ago.
To me, like the hardware generation part always seemed like the biggest technical risk in this. And that's just based on my experience in hardware. And now, I mean, your experience in hardware, I think, like, it's just a lot of work. Right? It's not trivial. It's not trivial to even ship like a very simple circuit.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I definitely did not, anticipate this amount of work that was involved. I mean, I knew it was expensive and I knew it took a lot of time, but it's, you really need to be dedicated for this to be successful. And not only are we doing this moonshot with the hardware, and we have this crazy approach where we're looking to give hardware to people all around the world for free, so that we distribute it widely and we have this decentralization, because there's no financial incentive to be running this thing, at least no direct financial incentive. And so if we want people to run it, at the minimum, we need to give them the hardware for free. But the other big moonshot is this RSA MPC. So the target that we have is to have 1,000 participants, so that there's really no question that there's at least one of these participants which is honest. But it turns out that doing MPCs at this kind of scale has never really been done. So very significant research breakthroughs were required to do this, in addition to just cryptographic engineering breakthroughs, to get this amount of scale, in the context of MPCs.
So what is like the bottleneck in the MPC?
Right. So you have different types of MPCs. The powers of tau stuff, which is what Zcash has done, is what I call asynchronous. Asynchronous meaning that anyone can contribute to the MPC at any point in time, and you don't need to know ahead of time who they are. And if for some reason they start making a contribution, but they go offline, then you can just move on to the next participant. And so what tends to happen is that these NPCs will drag on over many, many weeks, sometimes months, to get the required number of participants. In contrast, the RSA NPC is what is called synchronous, meaning that you need everyone to be online at the same point in time. And if any one of these participants goes offline, then you kind of need to identify that they've gone offline, kick them out, and restart with those who didn't go offline. And so what that means in practice is that you can't have the NPC last very long, because if it lasts, let's say, a whole hour, then the probability that at least one person will go offline during that hour is actually pretty big. So we've been working to squeeze it down to a smaller duration as possible.
And does every participant need to verify everyone else's work? So like that's kind of the, because to me, like having 1,000 people submit something in an hour seems fairly trivial, right? Like what, like
Yeah.
if you had like a single writable, chunk of memory somewhere in the world, like on Ethereum or on Solana, if you need it to be really cheap, right? Like you can just have people dump, read and dump whatever memory they need. And that could happen like fairly quickly. So like where does the bottleneck start to kind of aggregate?
Yeah, so in many MPC designs, you kind of need every participant to talk to every participant, every other participant, I mean. So you kind of have this log n, sorry, this n squared blow up. So if you have 1,000 parties, you're going to have on the order of 1 million messages which are communicated, and it starts becoming extremely expensive.
How big are the messages?
I mean, it depends on the MPC, but for us specifically, we're talking about 200 megabytes. 100 megabyte upstream, 100 megabyte downstream. The big optimization that we made, so 100 megabytes would be too much if we had to communicate with every single party, because that would, if you have 1,000 parties, that would be 100 gigabytes. But one of the optimizations that we made, it was basically to make use of a untrusted coordinator. So it's a coordinator which has a very big machine and lots of bandwidth. And it could be run by anybody, for example, someone from the VDF Alliance. And the cool thing is that they act as a coordinator in bridging the various participants, but you don't have to trust them for the security of your RSA modulus. And that means that basically every participant only needs to communicate with the coordinator, which drastically reduces the amount of communication that's going on. But even with the coordinator, the bottleneck is still, you know, to a very large extent, the communication cost. And one of the reasons is because you operate in rounds. So we have these 12 rounds of communication. And in order to start the next round, you need everyone from the previous round to have sent their message. So if you have even one participant that has a slow internet connection, they can just force everyone else to be waiting for them in order to complete the current round and move on to the next round.
Got it. At 100 megabytes, I can see that being a real issue. Like that starts getting into the realm of like there's this non-zero possibility of like 1 in 100 failure.
Right.
Is the asynchronous approach the Tower of Tau? Why does that take so long? If it is asynchronous, like what is the bottleneck there?
So the bottleneck there is that the size of your powers of tau will be linear with the size of the maximum size of the circuit that you want to support. So this is in the context of zero knowledge proofs. So you have these statements that you encode as circuits, you know, with addition gates and multiplication gates. And the more gates that you have, the bigger your circuit and the bigger the powers of tau. And, you know, people are starting to build circuits with millions of gates, if not tens or hundreds of millions of gates. And for every gate, you have one element in the powers of tau. So what you need to do is you basically need to download these millions and millions of elements, do computation on each of these elements, and then re-upload them back up. And so it can easily take hours, if not days, for a single participant to do the work required to count as one participant in this MPC. So, you know, just to give you an order of magnitude, Aztec, which is they're doing zero knowledge on top of Ethereum, and they did the ceremony which lasted 1 month, and they got 170 participants. You know, we're hoping to do a ceremony with 1,000 participants, which will last only 20 minutes. So it's kind of very different flavor of MPC.
Got it. That's a really interesting problem. I mean, like, I think the whole purpose of the space is to kind of build this trust minimization, both in terms of censorship resistance, but also in the cryptography side. It's really cool how these things intersect. Because, you know, like, I think the crux of decentralization is we can take so many untrusted parties that when they all have to coordinate, the likelihood of the entire set being corrupt in such a way that it can impact the users, it becomes like infinitesimally small, right? And that's interesting that that's also a problem for just building these cryptographic tools. A whole part, right? It is foundational in the sense that we're trying to leverage like this massive human computation that is so large that it's very likely that it was run in such a way that isn't corrupted. But it's pretty hard to do that. We don't have a mathematical definition for this, right? There isn't like some set of numbers that we are guaranteed have no factors but are semi-prime, right? Have no known factors that are semi-prime.
So actually, it turns out that there is a way to generate these semi-primes trustlessly. And the way that you do it is that you pick at random a very, very large number. And you can pick it in such a way that the probability that there's at least two large primes is extremely high. The problem with this approach, which is completely trustless, is that, you know, the random number that you have to pick is too big to be practical.
How big is it?
I will have to check my notes, but something like hundreds of thousands of bits. I mean, that we did do some research where it turns out that instead of picking one very big number, you can pick, let's say, 10 smaller ones, and it's a net positive from a probability theory standpoint. But even then, it was just too expensive. Because, I mean, one thing to consider is that these low latency modular multipliers, the size of the circuit, meaning the number of transistors that you have, grows quadratically with the bit length. So,
yeah.
You know, you really want to make sure that your bit length remains reasonable. But yeah, you make a really good point about, you know, the assumptions that we make in the blockchain space. We make cryptographic assumptions, but we also make kind of ceremonial assumptions. And in many ways, they share similarity. You know, in order to believe in them, you need to have some amount of faith. it becomes almost a religious kind of topic. And you're like, some people argue very strongly that, you know, we should never be doing these trusted setups, and instead be relying on cryptographic assumptions. But, you know, I think it's very difficult to compare the tail risk of these things. Like you could easily envision, for example, a cryptographic assumption where if you were to put, you know, an army of 50 really smart PhDs stuck in some basement of the NSA headquarters would be able to make very good, you know, cryptanalytic progress to break the assumption.
So like my intuition, and I don't have any proof for this, but I think these problems are so hard for a reason. And it's because I think it's impossible. I think there's some foundational limits to like creating a source of truth that's infallible, that's provable. Like it's just my intuitions, like based on like just my experience with math and computer science, there's like certain like boundary conditions of what we can do. And I don't think it's going to be possible for us to construct a totally trustless setup. Like the one that you described that uses an extremely large number is only trustless because of the probability that number is random, right? Like if it's using a true random oracle, but there's no guarantee, I'm guessing, that an attacker could manufacture a random number large enough that you would think is random, but is actually has some flaw in it.
Right. So there's this seed problem where...
Yep.
Yeah.
I don't think we will have... I'm betting that if there's people claiming that there's completely trustless assumptions, that I think there's going to be flaws in those setups discovered later by very smart engineers at NSA.
Yeah, I mean, what you want to try and do is remove as many of the assumptions. And one of the things that has been done in practice is to try and replace cryptographic assumptions with information theoretic assumptions. So information theory is just like pure maths and statistics. So there's no faith required there. And if you look at stocks, for example, that's a very good example where, like, the bulk of the heavy lifting is just information theory, and then you need to make essentially a couple of assumptions that are more faith-based. The first one being that you have some sort of hash function which behaves like a random oracle, or, you know, is collision resistant even, and then the other one being that this heuristic, which is called the Fiat-Shamir heuristic, can be applied. And here is that your hash function behaves like a random oracle. But, you know, as I said, we in the world of applied cryptography, we make these assumptions all the time. That's like almost the minimum assumption that you need to minimum viable in order to build something that's useful. And we have constructions today that only rely on these really minimal assumptions. So the future is bright. I guess we just need more research and development to make these things, you know, more practical, more efficient, etc.
Cool.
Usually there's a trade-off between the cryptographic stuff, which is very algebraic, and you can take these shortcuts because you have algebraic structure, relative to the information theory side of things, where there's no structure, so you can't take shortcuts, but you're making fewer assumptions at the cost of more overhead, maybe in terms of verification time or proof size and things like that.
Cool. Well, I mean, I think this was an awesome conversation, and super excited you were able to join, and I'm been following your progress. And from our perspective, when we have this hardware, we'd love to switch to something more efficient than our construction. I'm really excited you guys are working on this. And as always, awesome to talk to you. Thanks for being on here and giving me the download on everything that you're doing. Like, a huge part of the show is just me talking to folks like you and just learning from them, seeing what progress they're making. It sounds like you guys are making a ton of headway.
Yeah, I mean, we still have some big problems to overcome, especially around the RSA MPC. But if we can get through that, then I'm pretty optimistic.
Cool. Do you need this to kickstart the Beacon Chain?
No. So we will launch with RANDAO only to start with.
Got it.
And okay. Then we'll do this upgrade later on.
Cool. What's the right way to do it?
Yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot. And take care.
Cool. Take care, Anatoly. See ya.